On this episode of Skeptico, a look back on 200 episodes.
So there's your show, and you're up against all of the skeptic shows. There's Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Skepticality, Skeptoid.
Not really, Tim. Those are like two different universes. I mean, one of the things that Skeptico did, again, because I came in this from the outside, I saw naturally that these two things fit together. If the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and Skepticality and Skeptoid and all the rest of them are talking about parapsychology, albeit in a disparaging way, then naturally they're going to want to dialogue with those researchers. And I was naive enough to think that they actually did. What I found is that they don't. What they really want is to be left in their little island over there, in their little world, and talk about these things among themselves.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today on Skeptico, we're going to mix things up a little bit and have one of those retrospective shows. It is episode 200, after all, and maybe a look back is worthwhile. So my good friend, Tim, and that is his real name, but we won't use his last name, as I'll explain at the conclusion of this show, has joined me to talk about the show. There's not a lot of introduction required. Let's jump right into this look back at 200 episodes of Skeptico. So as I just mentioned, today we have a special episode of Skeptico. I have with me, and I'll soon be turning the mic over to Tim, who is a longtime friend of mine and a longtime friend of Skeptico, a guy who has literally listened to, I think, every show that I've produced. And what makes this particularly interesting, other than that I have this close personal relationship with Tim, is that Tim is a skeptic and he remains a skeptic. And I love the fact that he's stayed with the show, stayed with the material, has battled it out, and has remained a skeptic. So I think when Tim proposed the idea of doing an interview about Skeptico, something I've been resistant to do, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what more perfect person to conduct that interview than someone who's deeply engaged in the show and remains opposed to a lot of the ideas. And that true spirit of sorting out the data and skepticism, I can now turn the mic over to Tim.
Well, thank you very much, honestly, for agreeing to do this. You and I had a bit of a back and forth on whether or not you thought this was a good idea, but I do want to do this as primarily in my mind as a celebration of the fact that you've reached this milestone of 200 shows. So if you look back at Skeptico, it started January 7th, 2007. And you introduced it with how controversial science is debated. And so my ideas for the next few minutes is to talk about the show. And I was hoping we would stay out of the topics of the show. We may bleed into that. But I'm curious to get started with, how did the show get started? Take us back to 2007.
Well, you know, I started out as a listener. I've always been very interested in not only these topics, but in general, in the idea that I can learn, I can get better, I can improve by absorbing the knowledge from other people. So I was a listener, and I became quite interested in the whole idea of parapsychology and kind of paranormal phenomena, just at a very casual level, like anyone who watches TV. That eventually led me to Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, who is guest number one of Skeptico. And the conversation I had with Rupert was along the lines of, hey, this is interesting. Why isn't anyone talking about this in a serious way, interviewing these researchers and analyzing what they have to say versus what people who oppose them have to say? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, we ought to make that happen. And I'm willing to fund this. You know, let's hire somebody to go do the show. And that was really how it started, is I was going to fund a show because I'm not a producer of any sort and I'm not a radio guy or anything like that. Well, we went down that path, and I asked Rupert for suggestions of who might be good for the show, and that kind of played out. And it's like so many things you hear about, you know, there wasn't anybody, so I stepped in and to do it. And after a couple shows, really, I was pretty well hooked on doing it, and I was hooked on the fact that if I tried to subcontract this out, it wouldn't really fit what I was looking for. I wouldn't get the questions that I want asked and answered. Those wouldn't come on the table because everyone does bring a different perspective to these things. So that's really how it all started.
Did you get very far down the path of looking for somebody else to host the show?
Yeah. I mean, he threw out a couple names. I followed him up. There actually is one guy who appeared very early on in my interview with Michael Shermer, who we were considering for, you know, doing the show. And I actually met him here. He came down to Del Mar, and it wasn't a good fit. So I don't know if I exhausted all possible candidates, but yeah, we went down that path.
And what was Rupert's reaction when you said, "I'm just going to do this myself"?
Well, I think one of the other, you know, kind of little secrets that you learn when you get into this is I had this idea of some of these figures who are really, I respect tremendously, and their ideas are fantastic. Their books are fantastic, and their books are bestsellers and internationally known. But I think in my mind, and I think a lot of people's mind, you have this idea of this kind of infrastructure that lies behind them and that their tentacles reach out and all this. And it's not really the case. I mean, a lot of times it's a guy like Dr. Sheldrick who's has an academic career and has written a book, and you know, that's it. So in terms of me stepping forward and say, "Hey, why don't I do this show?" He was welcoming. He was like, "Great, fine, you know, let's try it." I think he saw it as not a lot to lose. He wasn't putting a lot behind it, and another chance to get his ideas out there, which is the other impetus of the show that really remained sound and true to this day, is that there's a lot of really important thinkers out there who don't get airtime. I think that's really probably less true now than when I started, because there's been a growth on the internet of shows like mine or shows in this general topic area that now cover these topics more thoroughly, which is fantastic. I think that's great. I'd love to be obsolete at some point.
So 6 years you've been doing this, which is roughly 30 a year, basically one every other week. You've kept up very consistent kind of pace. So if we'd asked you back in 2007, would you be doing this 6 years later? This is kind of like the question the Rolling Stones are getting now as they're getting into their 50th year. Everybody's asking them, would they have known that they would be doing it 50 years later? What if you had been told in January 2007 that you'd be doing this 6 years later?
I think, you know, even the comparison or the hint of the comparison of me and Skeptico with the Rolling Stones is something that I have to
That was deliberate on my part.
Yeah, I have to really tread very carefully there. No, you know what I've said repeatedly to people, and I've had to say it so that I can remind myself of it and gain as much humility as I can, and that's that this is my journey. You know, this is my little trick. This Skeptico show and the opportunity to provide this on the internet and iTunes and thousands of people and all that. Hey, man, that's just a little trick. So I get to call these people up and talk to them. Because if I just call them up and talk to them, no one would talk to me. So the idea of a show and a regular schedule and a continuation of it or anything like that is just, for me, an outgrowth of this desire to talk to folks. And so those are just that's just a vehicle that allows me to keep talking to the people I want to talk about. So, you know, whether I was thinking about 6 years or whether I think about 6 years in the future or whatever, it's just, I'm just on this journey.
Yeah. The whole area of, or the whole arena of podcasting. So you're in the, I think as we've spoken, you're in the tens of thousands of downloads kind of field there. You're the Evan Alexander, you said on YouTube, was in the hundreds of thousands of views. I'm sure you've thought about monetization of it. Has that ever really been something you've pursued at all?
No. You know, it's interesting. Both you and I share a business background. You know, we started our business career, our professional career together, and that's how we first became
sure
friends.
Did.
But I think we've also had that connection to the business world since then, you know, as most people who start down that career path. So there are a lot of business rules or lessons that I've learned that I think inform my decisions in Skeptico. And one of those is that this idea that do what you love and the money will follow is really a load of crap. I mean, I don't think that's true. And I think the way that applies to podcasting is if I wanted to apply my time and my mental resources towards increasing capital, I wouldn't do it by podcasting. Not to say that some people haven't found a way to monetize it and stuff like that, but I don't. That's not one. That's not my goal. And two, I don't think it's a very good way to make money. But maybe I should have started with the second point: is it's not my goal. It's not what this thing's about.
Do you get approached by advertisers?
Yeah, you do. But is there really any money there? I don't see it. You know. So
right. So what? So there's your show, there's and you're up against all of the skeptic shows. There's the
not really
Skeptics Guide to the Universe, Skepticality, Skeptoid.
Not really, Tim. Those are like two different universes. I mean, one of the things that Skeptico did, again, because I came in this kind of cold from just the outside, was I saw naturally that these two things fit together. You know, if The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and Skepticality and Skeptoid and all the rest of them are talking about parapsychology, albeit in a disparaging way, then naturally they're going to want to dialogue with those researchers. And I was naive enough to think that they actually did. What I found is that they don't. What they really want is to be left in their little island over there, in their little world, and talk about these things among themselves. And I don't know. I mean, there's a certain prejudice that I'm revealing in saying that, but I think that I think that's wrongheaded. I mean, how can you say you really want to have you want to engage in an intellectual kind of free thought, critical examination of these things without looking at the other side? It seems silly, yet that is the landscape. They really don't want to interact with anyone. And the same over here in the parapsychology community. I think for the most part, when I first got involved, there was not a lot of interaction with the skeptics other than just kind of this throwing stones over there and saying how stupid they are. So I guess I've bridged that a little bit. But then anyone who's been around the show for a while, as you know, that becomes tedious, tiresome, and worn out pretty soon too, because there's not a lot of real interaction there with the hardcore skeptics and atheists. They just kind of have this party line kind of thing that's hard to penetrate. What is effective is going to, I guess, the level two people behind that, the mainstream researchers in the field who more or less echo a lot of those same skeptical, materialist, atheist kind of worldview things, and kind of pulling them into this kind of debate and dialogue, I think, is fruitful and will remain fruitful for as long as I want to do it. There's no end of people that will engage in that dialogue, either knowingly or not knowingly, as we've found in Skeptico. Some people don't fully realize the dialogue they're getting into when they get into it.
They assume you're skeptical, and the conversation goes a different direction. You know, you've been on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and they've been on you. It sounded like you don't foresee that happening much in the future.
Oh, I've tried. I've pursued Steve Novella, you know, a half dozen times since then. So
right.
He used to respond, although very slowly, to my request. He doesn't respond anymore, which has been the case over and over again with skeptics. And they lose an argument and they run away. I mean, that sounds kind of harsh, but it really is the truth. There just should be so much more engagement with these issues in a debate format. Again, it really doesn't wash the skeptical position at the end of the day. It doesn't hold. I mean, I'm here. I will engage, debate, whatever you want to call it, anyone, anywhere, anytime. Anyone, that is, that has any audience or credentials or kind of certain reputation in this field. I don't know why anyone wouldn't do the same. I mean, if you think your ideas hold up, you got to say, hey, bring it on, you know? And
so I have gone through the 200 episodes, and I have tried, I've done my own completely unscientific categorization of all the shows. And I've also tried to, also count guests. So it probably no surprise that Dr. Sheldrick has been on the show the most times. I have him down for seven times. Novello, I have on four. Radford, Ben Radford, three times. Jeffrey Long, three times. And then a bunch of onesie twosies. The one thing that struck me when I was looking at that is that Dean Radin has only been on the show. It was on your second show. Yet he's never been on since. And although he is probably a name that you quote, you've probably quoted as often as Rupert Sheldrick in the course of recording the shows and recording the interviews. What is there a reason that Dean Radin had, I guess there was an email exchange during the Global Consciousness Project exchange, but I don't think he was actually on the show again. Is there any reason you haven't been able to get him back on the show?
Wow, you've really kind of dug into this stuff, done your research. Even when you pulled that Global Consciousness reference, I was going to mention that, and then you...
I am a fan of the show. Despite what you believe, I am a fan of the show. I've listened to all shows.
That's awesome. You know, I interviewed Dr. Radin another time, did a video interview of him. I have not published that. It's a few years old. I'd love to get around to publishing it at some point. But there really isn't any other reason why he hasn't been on the show. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Dean Radin. I think he's one of the real giants, if you will, in this field. I think his thinking is just always spot on. When I visit his blog, I'm always blown away. Sometimes I'm blown away by reading something going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I look up and it's 2009 or 2010, you know, several years ago.
Well, that sounds like a good topic for show 201, then. You should get him back on. So my categorization of it is, and these are very rough numbers, about a quarter is of the shows were related to NDEs, about 20% on psychic and paranormal activities and topics, and then kind of 15% associated with skeptics, just interviews back and forth with skeptics and believer, non-believer kinds of discussions. 10% on what I called religion, 10% on consciousness and so forth, 10% on dogs. Is that how you would have characterized the split of the show? Does it surprise you that NDEs is that prominent, almost one in four, kind of 25% of the content of the show?
Well, again, it's interesting when you break it down statistically, but then again, maybe it's not so interesting. I don't know what I really would pull from those stats, other than there's been this kind of evolution in the show. If you listen to the show and go back and listen to it, the NDE thing, near-death experience science, really comes up because if you look at the general lay of the land and you say there's kind of two models that science is dealing with, two paradigms. One paradigm is that we're all biological robots.
Materialism.
Scientific materialism. And you say, so there's that and there's something else. And then you dig into, is that true? Are we biological robots? And you start pulling that apart and you look at parapsychology and you look at the data and you look at science and philosophy of science and all that. Eventually, you come down to a lot of nitpicky, statistical, is that really significant? And kind of a Richard Wiseman, I accept the data, but that begs the question, do we need a better standard, you know, kind of thing. NDE science, near-death experience encounters, seem to kind of break through all that nonsense in a way that's really challenging to that atheistic materialistic worldview, because the medical profession really approaches this phenomena and these phenomena from a different standpoint. They say, we had this guy on the table, he died, and he came back and knew stuff that he wasn't supposed to be able to know. And doctors are very pragmatic people for the most part. They're interested in saving people's lives. So as that data has emerged, and then as researchers have tried to compile that into some meaningful scientific form, it's really created this, I think, very, very compelling body of evidence getting back to the biological robot question. That is, are we biological robots? And the NDE science, of course, comes back with a resounding no. Whatever we are, we're not biological robots. We have this consciousness that is, there is such a thing. And most importantly, it seems to survive our bodily death.
In my mind, the episode that really launched the arc of the show into NDEs was episode 94 with your interview with Jeffrey Long. But before that, you know, you'd spent a fair amount of time on interviewing the skeptics. You had a lot of episodes on just psi. You had your psi, your own psi experiments that you ran. And then there was episodes on the dogs, and then you got into what was certainly entertaining for the listener, the whole smackdown with Ben Radford and the psychic detectives.
Well, I think you've kind of pinpointed really a turning point in the show, at least in my mind, and that's that I had this idea starting out that it's about the data. You know, this is science after all, and science is concerned with measurement and data and evidence. And my thought was, hey, look, let's just try and get our arms around the data. Let's get good data, and then any reasonable person will be able to sort that out and decide one way or another. And I pretty quickly got an idea that maybe that wasn't as simple as I thought and that there were other things going on. But it was really in that series of interviews with Ben Radford that became clear in a way that it wasn't before. And that's, you know, when Ben says, just to fill people in so this isn't totally inside baseball, Ben and I did a follow-up series of interviews with these folks who are involved in this psychic detective case. So I picked the case, and then we actually interviewed the psychic medium who helped the police. We interviewed two police officers, a Captain Moore and a Lieutenant Hughes in New Jersey, who had investigated this case. And I interviewed those folks, and then Ben interviewed those folks. And then we got back on and did this, as you say, Smackdown thing.
That was the title of the show, was Smackdown.
Yeah. And you get to this point where this medium has given this rather amazing body of knowledge to the police and have told them without any prior knowledge, any way of knowing any of these things, that there's a killer. The killer is from New Jersey. The killer is from this little local area called The Hollow. The killer went down to Florida, committed a murder there, was imprisoned, got out, came back, and then committed these crimes. So that's part of what the psychic said, but I'll get to the point here in a minute. The controversy between Ben and I came down to whether or not one of the detectives remembered that instead of saying that the killer went to Florida, he remembered the psychic saying that the killer went to the South.
Reinforcing the notion that the psychics throw wide nets out there and try and get hits with wide comments like that, as opposed to something specific like Florida.
Right. But, I mean, it's preposterous, right? I mean, it's completely crazy, given all the other things that the psychic has gotten right, and the fact that, you know, one person specifically, one of the detectives specifically remembers Florida, and the other guy remembers the South. Well, actually, we even did a follow-up interview with this guy. I insisted that right then we got him on the phone, and he says to me, and he says to Ben, hey, I might have said the South in the general sense, but I do remember Florida. So this should have been the end of it, but it's not. Ben persists. He brings this up again and again. And to this day, I don't know if he's willing to kind of concede that point. But the whole thinking with a guy who's an otherwise likable, intelligent guy, Ben Radford, and how he can remain completely married to these beliefs and to this interpretation of the data that just doesn't fit with just the kind of common sense understanding of it really sent me in a different direction and saying, you know what? It's not about the data. It's really about everything else. It's about why we believe what we believe, how our belief systems develop, how our belief systems change. And until we really figure that stuff out, then all this stuff about the data is more or less a sideshow, because people will always be able to say it's the South, it's not Florida, if they want to.
And when we spoke last week, it was interesting. I asked you, why did you revisit? Because episodes 151 and 153 was revisited, I think, on Skepticality, or you jointly published the show. What? And you said that Ben came back to you?
You know, it was actually another podcaster, a guy by the name of Blake Smith, and he hosts a show called Monster Talk. And
Monster Talk, right.
Right. So he became interested in Skeptico and this debate, and was nice enough really to kind of pull this back together and say, hey, let's kind of get some resolution on this. And Ben had kind of gone his way, and I had kind of thrown some pretty sharp barbs at him, and I guess he wasn't really too interested in coming back. But Blake talked him into coming back, and I was like, sure. Like I said, I mean, I am anytime, anywhere on this stuff.
And that was evidence of it, Alex, because that was probably 4-on-1, right? There was Blake, and he's got a co-host, and there was Ben, and they were all kind of going after you on that thing. But it's interesting that they would bring it up that much later. What was his interest in rehashing it?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the medium of podcasting is that these things live forever in time. And it's one of the real fun things for me is getting emails from folks who say, hey, I just discovered the show on episode 140, and I've decided to go back and listen from the beginning. You know, I think, wow, that's so great. I mean, I've done that so many times in exploring something and getting interested in it, and then finding that there's this library that I can go back and listen to. So I think the time sequencing thing, and the fact that, you know, Blake, for example, discovered this thing that had happened a year ago and yet felt it being immediate and present to what he wanted to deal with is I think part of the whole thing.
So those kinds of shows, those I think you called the number 68, the SmackDown, those kinds of shows were, they're very stark contrast between you and who you're interviewing. There's Radford, you had Brian Dunning on. Do you like doing those shows when you know that you're going to be going head-to-head with somebody that fundamentally disagrees with you?
I don't like those, but I don't seem to dislike them in the way that other folks do. When I do those shows, the reaction is usually polarized. There's so many people, and this always surprises me, who are proponents, believers, if you will, who are really offended. I mean, they just don't like controversy. You can see, and they don't like this kind of confrontational, battling it out kind of thing. And that always surprises me. I don't know how you really get to the bottom of things that you care about deeply or that you have strong opinions about without having a little bit of friction. And the other thing I guess I'd say about that is that while I don't seek those shows out, and I don't think those need to be the main focus of Skeptico, I do feel a need to revisit those topics every now and again, because one of the conclusions that I came to in this, hey, it's not about the data, it's about everything else, is there's a question I think in the back of everyone's mind, which is, how can this be? I mean, here's this guy or here's this group of people who are saying fundamentally, the scientific model that we have is flawed. And the immediate question you have to be is, how can that be? Wait a minute. I have this iPhone 5 here that is a testament to how great science is. So don't tell me science is wrong. How can this be? So I think we have to occasionally go back and revisit that and really look hard at what the other folks have to say. The folks who say, no, you are a biological robot. Life does have no meaning, and it's all about machines. I think we do have to go back and give them the floor every once in a while and hash that out with them.
I mentioned NDEs, and NDEs has been a pretty prevalent topic, and you think, as you described, you think it's a pretty important topic in what you're pursuing with the show. There was the Jeffrey Long in 94, episode 94, and then you had just a whole series. You finally got Sam Parnia on 116, I have down. He is doing that, it's called the AWARE study, I believe. Is there any update on where that is?
I don't know if we'll be able to get Dr. Parnia back on. I certainly hope so when the AWARE study is published. As far as the updates, I think there's a lot of people that are fascinated by that work. I don't know currently what the status is, but the last time I checked, they had really not published a lot of information. They've let out some little hints here and there about what might be coming, but again, it's kind of in the future we'll have this. Of course, my take on the AWARE study is that it's kind of a sleight of hand, if you will, in that here's a study that's gained a tremendous amount of attention and focus within the NDE research community, and it's really a replication of a study that produced null results. I mean, the idea that you can have an image above the hospital bed of a patient that suffers cardiac arrest and that they'll be able to leave their body and see that. There's a lot of problems in that experiment, as we explored in that show, and that Dr. Parnia is willing to admit are problems. But moreover, when they ran the pilot study for that, they didn't get any positive results. So usually you take that as a sign of either there's nothing there, which I think is not usually the kind of conclusion that you draw from a pilot study, or you'd say, gee, we need to rework this in a way where we can get some data that we can really wrap our arms around. And as I also pointed out and point out again and again on the show is, in that same series of experiments, if you will, there was research done by Dr. Penny Sartori and Dr. Peter Fennick where they did a simpler thing and they just went and talked to the people after they had cardiac arrest. And they said, do you remember your resuscitation process? Do you remember the specifics of it? And then they compared the accuracy of that with the accuracy of patients who had suffered a cardiac arrest but didn't have a near-death experience. And they had a very statistically significant result from that. And Jan Holden from the University of North Texas did a similar experiment, published the results, also had significant results. So according to Dr. Parnia, he is going to include that kind of data and that kind of analysis in the AWARE study, but he kind of leads with this idea of people are going to float outside of their bodies and see these pictures on the wall because, again, in the reality of selling science and communicating these ideas and the ways that people can grab onto, that's certainly an idea that's captured the imagination of people across the board, believers to kind of hardcore skeptics as being a good way to run this experiment. Although I don't think it is a good way, but anyways, that's the general sentiment.
The Jeffrey Long interview I thought was interesting in that is when I listened to it, I got my sense was wow, you've got the guy you've been searching for. He's got that was a New York Times best-selling book, if I remember correctly. I saw him, he was on national media, the Today Show. Do you think that he changed the public dialogue, the broad public dialogue, and the perception of NDEs and what it means to our existence? Do you think it really moved the needle?
I don't know. You can look at it both ways. You can look at it in terms of all the things that you said, New York Times bestseller, national media, follow-on books, success, success, success. Or you can look at it and say, but the persistence of the counter atheistic idea that this is all just an illusion has also persisted and has also gone forward in the mainstream science media and has continued to play and get out there too. So it depends, you know, is the glass half empty or half full? Also, if you look at it from a historical perspective, there's certainly been a lot of NDE books since Raymond Moody on that have gained a lot of this kind of attention and this kind of traction among the general population. And yet the persistence of the biological robot paradigm continues.
And Eben Alexander seems to be hitting. He's had arguably even more success with his book, and my wife mentioned that she heard him on NPR or something. So he's running up against the same resistance, you believe?
Well, it's funny because there obviously isn't the resistance, right? So he, New York Times bestseller, number one on Amazon, Oprah, right. NPR, all the media outlets. You can't sit back and say there's resistance, but where there is resistance is in the within the scientific community in accepting this or putting any kind of serious resources behind looking at these questions. Because there's a lot of ways to do it, as we've explored on the show. It's not like this is completely outside the realm of what science can investigate, certainly outside the realm of what medicine can investigate. It's not, but yet it's ignored. So before we celebrate, you know, the coming paradigm shift, I think we have to take a good look at even this brief little snippet of history and learn a lesson from that and be very cautious in our optimism that there is going to be a lot of change.
Is the paradigm shift coming?
I don't see a lot of evidence for it. Then again, in a recent interview with Dr. Mario Beauregard, I asked him that question directly, and I thought he had a very strong argument for the fact that there is this change. And he's a neuroscientist in Montreal, and he says, hey, at my university, at my conferences, in the journals that I publish in, I definitely see a shift, a change in the openness to these ideas in the last 10 years. So maybe I'm being too pessimistic.
Let's talk about the forum. Talk to me about the role that the forum and the message boards play in Skeptico today.
Well, the forum was actually started by a Skeptico listener. Jacob, who lives in Israel, contacted me, oh boy, I think it was a lot earlier than episode 100. And he was somebody who was really interested in the show and said, hey, you know, it would be great if we had a forum for this. Why don't I run this? And he has a website called mindenergy.net. He thought it fit in general and the topics that he liked to cover. And he's a guy who stepped forward and said, hey, let me run a forum for Skeptico. And I was like, great. Which is, you know, one of the things that has always been in the back of my mind about Skeptico is this idea of a community project, not just me, but people who are interested in these topics often don't have a lot of other outlets. I love to engage with those people and get them involved in the project that is Skeptico. So it's totally fitting to have somebody like Jacob step forward and run that to me. And he's been fantastic. I'm really grateful for his help because there is, you know, a fair amount of work in running that. And then in the last year, Andy Paquette, who is someone who's been on the show and has been a guest host on the show and someone who has become a friend of mine through the show, offered to step forward and do moderation of the forum. So again, it's the help and support of people who are kind of involved and engaged in the process of Skeptico who really make things better in a way. And I think the forum moderation that Andy has done has kind of made for an improved dialogue on the forum.
Were you playing that role previously?
Not very well.
So you do view that as an integral part. It makes it more than just a one-way communication. It's an important thing to Skeptico to have the forum.
I think it is. At the same time, I've never been involved in a forum before I was involved in Skeptico, so I don't really know. I've had to learn myself what that interaction is like and really how you relate to people and how all that evolves. But for me, it's been a tremendous experience, and I've learned so much from people who've engaged with me in the forum and either have ideas or you get into these long, sometimes lengthy back and forth. And I've grown tremendously from the forum. And besides, I've gotten a lot of ideas for guests from the forum as well.
That's great. Is there any desire to take it further, to do a conference? What would be the next step in the Skeptico community? Is there any thoughts along those lines?
Not so much by me. I like the fact that the technology allows me to break away for a couple of hours, do an interview, come back a couple days later, edit it, come back a couple days later, post it, and just be able to fill in gaps of time with doing this. I think that's great. I'm a little bit reluctant to commit to the kind of all-out effort that a conference or conference going, you know, might take. I wouldn't rule it out completely, but no, I don't see that happening anytime in the near future.
Let me throw a three phrases that you've gotten a lot over the years on Skeptico, and tell me which one of these is your least favorite. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Susan Blackmore explained NDEs, or NDEs are due to elevated oxygen levels.
Oh, my favorite is extraordinary claims that require extraordinary proof. Far and away the winner, because I think it really...
It is remarkable how many, almost every skeptic that was on the show at some point said that. And for those of us that were listeners, we were always kind of waiting for the... After they started saying it, I was anticipating your response back. And you're often fairly measured with it. But it was interesting how every one of them at some point would say... Would spout that at some level.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to not go down the party line thing, you know, that they've all been taught these talking points, party line arguments, and they kind of regurgitate them without a lot of thought. And I think sometimes that's the case. But I think it's also true that at another level, even though that's a silly statement, because, of course, as we've talked about so many times, the whole idea of the enterprise of science is to remove us from our biases and prejudices and not introduce such subjective measures as extraordinary. Well, what's extraordinary to you, Tim? What's extraordinary to me? Those are obviously subjective, and those are the things we want to get out of it. So the idea that we would introduce those back in is silly. But at the same time, you know, we have to acknowledge, like all these things that people say that don't make a lot of sense, there is an underlying truth that you do have to kind of tease out of there. And that's that, hey, practically speaking, we do demand more evidence for information or phenomena or theories that lie beyond our day-to-day experience. So there is some truth to that, even if people don't always say it in the right way or have the ability to kind of back it up from a logical, critical thinking standpoint.
So you have had a lot of skeptics on the show. You know, you go back to the beginning, you had Wiseman and Randy and just the whole host of them. Novella, who's your favorite of that group? Who did you walk away with the most respect for?
Oh, wow. Those are two different questions.
I guess they are different questions, aren't they? So let's take respect first, and then which one did you like second?
I guess the one that I respected the most was Dr. Robert Price, the noted atheist and now host of Point of Inquiry, which is a very interesting atheist materialistic podcast that really does a nice job in what they do. And I've interviewed several of their hosts, including DJ Grothy, is someone else I enjoyed talking to and spoke with a couple times, and I have a certain respect for both of those guys, even though, as you'll hear in the interviews, I can't really buy into their worldview. As far as favorites, the one that jumps to mind is Dr. Victor Stenger, who was just on episode 191. And what I really liked about that is I think for anyone who's halfway fair-minded, the guy just completely blows it on his understanding of near-death experience research. It just couldn't be more clear that someone is just out to lunch and yet is highly respected among the atheist skeptical community. Anyone could have exposed this guy. So it was just kind of fun and I think skeptico-worthy to kind of point out some of the errors in his critical thinking.
So what is Skeptico all about, Alex? What you describe it as your journey. It looks like it began, certainly from my read, is kind of an exploration of the skeptical argument and then perhaps exposing that. You describe it as your journey. What do you mean by that? Is it something that you just pick up on a day-to-day basis and you see what new topic in this area interests you and you just start pursuing that? Or is there an overall arc that you're trying to drive Skeptico.
Okay, well, I think, again, there's a couple of different questions in there, but that's good. I understand where you're going, I think. And I guess I'd say, to me, at a very kind of deep personal level, I always wondered why everyone wasn't interested in these topics. Why I always wondered why these weren't the first and foremost questions on everyone's mind. I mean, most of us spend so much time on ridiculously silly things of the weather or sports or news or all the rest of that, when the big questions are, who are we really? What happens to us after we die? How are we related to not only each other, but the universe? I mean, these are the big, big, big questions. And I guess I always had a sense of, hey, am I not getting the newsletter here? I mean, does everyone else know the answers to these? Because why isn't this foremost on everyone's mind? And then you kind of get into life and you want to make a living and you want to have a family and all that. We all understand that. And you say, hey, I can't deal with all those things right now. They don't seem to be pressing as much as the mortgage payment or the car payment is. So I kind of put them to the side. But to me, they always seem to be the questions that I wanted to come back to. So that really is the driving force of Skeptico, along with the idea that I had all along because of my business experience. And that was the idea that I can learn, I can get better, I can improve, because I was someone who, despite having the right academic background and education background, was failing pretty miserably at business before I kind of went on a massive kind of learning campaign in terms of how to make myself better and how to improve in that. So I kind of took that self-improvement idea and that self-improvement success that led to business success and said, hey, I can bootstrap myself into knowing the answer to these big, big questions. And that's really been, I guess, the driving force of Skeptico.
So when you started, and I tried to find this, I don't know if I found the definitive episode, it was somewhere in the 40s, I believe, where you, early on in Skeptico, you were talking about psi topics and you'd have skeptics on and so forth, but it was in the 40s when you actually started to use the word believer, where you said, I am a believer. Do you remember saying that and putting that out there in Skeptico?
Yeah, I don't specifically remember that, and that isn't such an important title to me, other than one of the topics I think that has been a recurring theme of the show is how we communicate about these topics in the court of public opinion, if you will. And a lot of people will kind of have a knee-jerk reaction when I mention God or when I mention believer or when I mention any of these things. And when I'm pressed, like in the forum, I'm quick to acknowledge that I don't know what God means. I don't have any specific idea of a guy in a beard or anything like that. But I'm using a shorthand reference to kind of shoehorn us into the public debate. I mean, the big debate is science versus religion. Whether we like it or not, that's what's out there. That's what's socially relevant in terms of the discussion. So in that sense, okay, I'm a believer. If you want to divide the world into skeptics and believers, I'll gladly take the side of believer. I don't think that term means anything to me other than it means if we're going to engage in this dialogue and there has to be sides, this is the side I'll take for purposes of this discussion.
Are you saying that you're taking that side because that's where you're biased, or are you taking that side because you know you're not a skeptic?
I know I'm not a skeptic in terms of the way that the skeptical proposition is offered currently. I mean, I think scientific materialism is a failure. I mean, it's a failed proposition. It was a good proposition. I think the evidence is overwhelmingly suggestive that that just doesn't hold up. And I think with it, atheism falls down the drain as well. So I think those propositions are falsified. So yeah, that would push me to whatever other category you want to call it. You know, I'm going to be closer to that other side.
So one quote that stayed with me, Steve Volk, the author of Fringeology, said in that interview when you're discussing the book, he said, "You see answers, I see questions." Do you remember that quote, and can you reflect on that?
I do, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because I think that would bring this to a very personal level between you and I, because I think you would be more of the Steve Volk kind of mindset, and probably even further, even on the skeptical side, and I wouldn't. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I think it's a really important point, at least for me, and that's that I don't think the middle holds here. I don't think the, oh, I'm agnostic, I just have questions about this, I don't think it holds. And the reason it doesn't hold is because you have to make a decision every day in the way that you live your life. We live in a materialistic world, a materialistic economy, and a materialistic society. That is the predominant worldview that's placed upon you. If you do nothing, you are thereby embracing materialism. So you can't say, I'm removed from this discussion. You're in the middle of it. You're the fish. You're in the water. The water is all around you. So you can't say, I'm agnostic. Your life is your choice. And I've had numerous conversations with Steve, who has become a friend of mine through the show, and just a really terrific guy who I really enjoy talking with. But along these lines, that the middle doesn't hold. There really isn't a middle ground. Life forces us to choose one way or another.
So you say that, but on a recent episode, I believe it was with somebody on topics of UFOs, where you said there was a discussion of the truth, and you said something along the lines of there is no the truth, and that's a reality that you'd come to. It's about the journey. So you seem to be indicating that it is more about an ongoing exploration for you, as opposed to being a hardcore, having come down one side or the other on the believer skeptic, the continuum.
Well, again, it's kind of hard. You know, one of the things I've come to appreciate about this biological robot, scientific materialism that I bash repeatedly because it's so strongly ingrained, enmeshed in our culture, and yet it doesn't hold up. And that just kind of galls me from a critical thinking standpoint. How can something so wrong have such traction? So I'm always bashing it. On the other hand, especially lately, I've come to appreciate how hard and difficult it is to get beyond that, and how reassuring it is to fall back on the notion of materialism. I mean, everything gets really, really fuzzy when you kind of go into this post-scientific materialism realm. And by that, I mean, what is reality? I mean, if consciousness is fundamental. So this debate of biological robots is that, you know, you're just a robot, you're just a machine. And the counter theory is that in some way we don't understand this thing of consciousness, this me, this ghost inside the machine is fundamental. So matter isn't fundamental, consciousness is fundamental. That's one hypothesis. Well, what does that really mean? It means that all these ideas of measurement, all these ideas of reality, if you will, have to be put on hold. So we can no longer in that world talk about reality or talk about our experience or talk about things like time. It all kind of falls apart. So in that sense, what I've said before, and I think it holds, is that, hey, I'm going to play this little game with you called consensus reality. And we're going to pretend that this desk that I'm tapping on is real, is solid, even though we know it's 99.99999% nothing. It appears solid to me. You can see it. I can see it. We're going to call this reality. And in that same way, we're going to call all these things that we debate about reality. And we're going to call skeptics on this and this and that. But at the same time, while we're doing that, we have to acknowledge that that might all be just kind of a game, if you will. And there may be a bigger, larger truth out there that we're not really dealing with when we talk about things in that way. And that's pretty abstract, but I think you can see where I'm going and why it's necessary to kind of talk out of both sides of your mouth when you talk about skeptics versus believers or scientism or even scientific evidence.
So that does get out there. Is that the direction that you're going to take the show to continue? So that's the synchronicity kind of topics and some things that you've been exploring recently on the show. The reality is not really reality kinds of topics. Is that where your current interests are lying?
Not too much, because there really isn't a lot to go there, right? I mean, as soon as you jump into that other realm, then what is there to talk about? A couple of areas I want to pursue further, and they really have a tendency to polarize people, or maybe more accurately, to really put people off. But one of the nice things about doing a show like this and not caring too much about growing your audience as much as you can or appealing to a certain crowd is that you don't have to worry if people are put off by these topics. But one topic is UFOs and the ET hypothesis. I think it's central. I've explored it a little bit in terms of how that might relate to consciousness, what those reports mean. But I think wrestling that to the ground and figuring out as best you can what the reality of that is central to answering these big picture questions. And it's another one.
What is the ET hypothesis?
Whether there are extraterrestrial beings or not is the ET hypothesis.
Well, the show has introduced me to many terms. I tried to write them all down: NDE, synchronicity, singularity, precognition, precognitive dreams, remote viewing, neuroplasticity. And I look forward to hearing about the ET hypothesis. Thank you, Alex, for agreeing to be a guest on your own show. And it's been a pleasure listening to the last 200 shows. And please keep the shows coming, Alex.
Tim, thanks so much for doing this. I'm really glad we did it, and I hope people find value in it. Thanks again. Okay, one quick final note to wrap things up here on episode 200, and that is that I want to thank Tim, but I can't use Tim's last name. Quite telling, I think, that a week or so after the interview, Tim emailed me and said, "Hey, you know, I have a lot of corporate things. I may be doing some board of directors and some public corporations. Maybe I shouldn't use my last name." Now, I understand that. I understand that completely. It's for the same reason that so many people don't use their real name in the forum. But isn't it a little bit strange that we can walk down this path and we can all have this conversation about belief, about what's important and what we know? And we have a tendency, no matter how many times we bring it up, to gloss over the reality that we live in a world, in a society, that has made these kind of topics taboo. So that leads me to one question that I'd like to tee up for episode 200, and that is, why are so many of the topics we talk about on Skeptico taboo? Hey, I really do hope you've enjoyed this look at Skeptico. If you'd like more information about the show and you're not already a listener or familiar with all our previous shows, please check out the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. And there you can also find links to join in a conversation with us about the show. You can leave a comment directly there on the website or click on our forum link and jump over there and join the conversation on our forum. Well, I have several interesting shows coming up. They're kind of stacking up again, so I'm probably going to be on an every week schedule for a little while. I hope you can keep up, but I just can't stop doing these interviews. There's so many interesting people to talk to. So please fire up that iPod, and while you're at it, fire off an email to your friend or write a blog and tell as many people as you can. Share the word about Skeptico so we can continue to grow this community and expand the conversation as far as we can. Okay, that's going to do it for this time. Do take care, and bye for now.